Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Ryan Falvey. Ryan is the founder and investor with Restive Ventures. Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Super excited to dive into Restive. And with that, why don't we start with the firm's investment thesis?
Yeah, so we're early stage fintech focused investors. So trying to be, goal is really to be the first institutional money into founders so that in many cases we are literally the first call that a founder might have as they're getting ready to start a company. Typically pre-seed, seed stage investors. So really that whole kind of your early stage ecosystem is where we try to play. So we tend to look for more technical teams, people who can, designers, engineers, developers, people who can code, who might have a great idea and the skills to execute on that, but just might not have the network and financial services that allows them to do as quickly as they could. So what we try to do is bring that expertise, bring our network to those founders at the earliest stages, hopefully unlock some early growth, help to, you know, if they, there's a kind of key partnership they need to make, bring a product to market, or help to kind of turbocharge early sales motion and get them going. And then we look to then build on our positions in the companies and grow our relationship with them as the companies grow and scale. There's three of us on the team that are investing right now. We're all partners here and really looking to become an extension of the management team of our founders. And so all of us are former founders and operators and can really like to roll up our sleeves and get involved. And particularly for that first, you know, 12 to 24 months after the company's been created, we can have a real big impact on the companies we work with.
Well, you started to answer my next question, but what was the genesis behind Restive? Why financial services? Why fintech?
Yeah, I mean, A, it's what we know. I mean, all of us have been doing this for our whole careers. And then I think what's, you know, really interesting around financial services is it's just a really, I don't know, idiosyncratic and very specific market. So, I mean, as someone yourself, you know, who works in this industry, you know, there's a lot of different layers of it. You see, so you know, there's, you know, a couple hundred thousand people that work at a bank like a JP Morgan. They all have totally different jobs. Within that bank, there's probably dozens of businesses that do over $1 billion a year of revenue. And so if you're just trying to come in that from the outside, let's say you're a really strong, you know, engineer at Stripe and you have a great idea on how you want to, you know, revolutionize payments. Well, you probably don't even necessarily know how Stripe moves payments and how Stripe is a really complex business at this point. And so much less like who you'd go to try to think about like developing something really early. And you might spend a lot of time kind of networking and trying to work your way through the industry. And that kind of just that complexity and, you know, the just specificity of it creates barriers to entrants coming into it. And we think this is a huge market. You know, we focus on the US mostly. I think it'd be hard to part pressed outside of maybe big tech to find an industry that has such a durable source of profits and revenue. Probably represents about 15% of the global profits, you know, probably a little more of that global revenue. And it's a highly fragmented industry. There aren't, you know, super dominant players. And so it's one that's very ripe for technology to disrupt it and change it. And often what those technologists need is that connectivity and those relationships. And if we can bring that to them, it can, you know, create a lot of value. And so, yeah, that's really, it's a combination of it's an industry we know, and it's one that makes for really extreme outcomes for venture if you can find the right founding teams really early.
Makes great sense. And it's consistent with themes that we've heard on the podcast with other investors. But of course, there's still your personal perspective. So yeah. If you can share your career progression leading up to Restive.
Yeah, so I've always kind of worked in financial services. Actually, when I was in high school, I was actually a teller at Wells Fargo Bank. So it's been in it for a bit now. I after graduate school, I worked in emerging markets actually. So I started my career working in about 60 different countries over about 5 years, doing a lot. to think about how to use mobile technology and the internet. This is, you know, kind of 2008 to 2013 to really extend financial services in many places where it just wasn't, you know, functional, for lack of a better word, for you know, before that. So I saw kind of firsthand the power of technology to really change markets. And I leveraged that, came back, was working in the US for a while, actually for a bank that was very focused on banking technology startups. And we saw a lot of these, you know, what we now would call fintech companies kind of coming through the door. And I saw kind of two things happening. One, that these startups were just way more sophisticated than we were giving them credit for and moving at a really high speed. And two, that the bank was just not really positioned to help them very much. Like they just weren't, I mean, they just weren't thinking about these opportunities the same way. And I was like, well, I gotta get on the startup side of it here in this market, because that's where the real innovation is gonna be driven. And so I had an opportunity to start an accelerator that was actually backed by JP Morgan Chase called the Financial Solutions Lab. And so I started my investment career running NAT starting in about 2015. Made a number of pretty good investments. And so by 2017, we had a lot of interest from other investors to put money behind what we were doing. That wasn't really the goal of JP Morgan and their partners. And so myself and my co-founder of Restive, Tyler Griffin, left and started this in early 2018. And really, we're just taking that kind of kernel of insight that we had gained, you know, with the earlier accelerator, that these companies didn't necessarily need capital as much as they needed connections and insight. And so if we could bring that could have a real big impact on the companies.
Whole bunch to unpack here.
Yeah.
Let me see where it makes good sense to start. Let's just talk about... you know, I heard you mention your perspective of looking at some of these founding teams and their technology relative to big banks. Mm-hmm. And so we're all aware, you know, making sales, facilitating cash flow is a really big deal for purposes of bringing a company to life. And so what are some of the key takeaways that you've learned for financial services, fintech focused, early stage companies need to put their attention in order to be successful in the beginning innings?
They just need to go as fast as they possibly can. I'd say is it. They need to just iterate as quickly as they can, focus on shipping products as quickly as they can, making sales as quickly as they can, growing customers. Like whatever their kind of variable they're focused on is, like they just need to go faster. I mean, the advantage you have as a startup is that you can move more quickly than the incumbents. And the incumbents in financial services move extraordinarily slowly. And so there's just a huge opportunity for those teams that can move quickly. And I say that's focus on execution. It compounds as these companies get bigger, that the fastest moving companies kind of tend to even grow faster and faster. And so it is really, I mean, that's like I kind of the biggest takeaway. I've just been struck by how quickly the best teams move at the earliest stages and how that focus and speed just compounds dramatically over time.
And so do you see patterns then among ICP? Does it typically exclude larger corporations?
Like your initial customers and stuff? Yeah, generally. I mean... Yeah, you know, well, I mean, you know, consumer stuff, obviously, you know, you're selling to consumers, small business kind of functions similarly to that. I mean, there's a pretty, they're large, the U.S., these are large markets. And so your ability to kind of drive growth and acquisition there is really critical. You know, more enterprise plays, you know, the kind of the playbook you see most commonly is starting to sell to other startups who will have a more acute pain point. Mm-hmm. That's partly because the other startups are starting in the industry, and so they might not have a compliance solution. They might not have a great, you know, CRM solution. They might not have a great set of tools to manage their own CFO stack and their own financial management. And so that's why I think you see a lot of startups initially targeting other startups, maybe slightly larger ones. And that you can get the product in the hands of customers, see what's working, allow them to follow the customers as they grow and evolve and get bigger. And I think at some point, you can make the leap to larger firms and sell into them. But yeah, it is it, if we, yeah, we met a startup and they were saying their first client was going to be, JP Morgan. I doubt we would invest in that company.
Founders in the audience, take heed. I agree with Ryan 100%. Okay, so let's, then you spend time in Financial Solutions. It was the name of the accelerator. Congrats on the success. What were some of the patterns you saw with those companies who were exceeding the benchmark and really getting some great traction?
No, it's a good question. And I think again, the pattern we see, I mean, not to sound like a little bit of like a broken record, but like it really is just, I mean, speed of execution is a huge piece of it. Like how fast these teams are evolving. And I will say it's a little bit like a race. Like it's really difficult. It's impossible to look at somebody just at face value and determine like, is this person going to be a fast runner or not? Might look at their height, might look at their gender, look at all sorts of, things that you think are indicative of if they're fast or not. And maybe it might be directionally accurate, but if, 10 people got to a starting line and started racing, one of those people is probably much faster than the others. And your pattern recognition before you saw them run is almost certainly wrong. And I think what's remarkable about startups is the team that's the fastest is almost like if we just got a line of just random people and then put them next to Usain Bolt and had them run. He would be so much faster that it would be shocking. You'd be like, well, I mean, this is at a totally different level. And so the best startups are like that. They are moving at a completely different speed than even the second fastest. Generally, to continue to maintain that speed advantage, they often tend to be relatively technical. Because you think they're like using their fingers to code. So like if there's an error and they can fix it with their hands, like that's going to make them a lot faster than if they have to like, email somebody to go fix it and for them. So you see really strong technical DNA in these companies pretty early. As they grow and scale, you'll see that start to evolve where they're hiring other people who are also equally strong. And that technical DNA could go to, if it's a consumer product where maybe there isn't much engineering and development involved in it, or it's more design. You'll see that technical DNA kind of continue to flow to user acquisition and marketing strategies and those kinds of things, where you really have really strong, competent people who are being empowered to make decisions as the companies grow. I'll say like the founders, we tend to see the most success with. They're very ambitious, obviously, but they have a very long-term focus. They're not really focused on, the Series A, the Series B. I mean, they'll focus on those things, but their focus is much broader. Like, hey, I'm going to change, how consumers interact with their bank. I'm going to change how, compliance works in the country. I'm going to create a new money system. I mean, they have huge ambition that they're driving towards, not just like the next kind of milestone. They tend to be motivated by non-financial, like almost always they're motivated by non-financial outcomes. The average IPO in fintech over the last 20 years, about $4 billion. I'm pretty confident there's no company that's gone public for $4 billion didn't have the opportunity to sell itself for hundreds of millions of dollars before that. And, hundreds of millions of dollars, lots of money. It's more than anyone really needs and can use in a lifetime. So to move past that offer and say like, no, I'm just going to grind it out and I'm going to like take this company to the next level is a motivation. It's not just a financial one. It's usually like, no, I actually believe in this thing, or they're driven by some other intrinsic motivator that's important to understand when you're working with the companies. They can sell.
Sure.
Selling, I mean, it's like the main thing founders do, especially as they get bigger. So you want to see them start to develop that skill. And then the other thing is, kind of like harder to see, but when you're working with somebody, is this a kind of combination of being both inquisitive and decisive. If you ever had a boss that's always, changing the goals and they make a decision one day and then they come 2 days later and they're coming back to the decision. It's extremely difficult to accomplish big things there because you just never really feel like you know what you're supposed to be doing. And so you just kind of wait. And if the alternatives are your boss, where they might solicit everyone's feedback and then they make a decision in the meeting and that's it. We move on. And it might not have been the right decision, but we made the decision. And so if we turn out in like a year that was the wrong decision, we come to their meeting, we take more feedback, maybe we make a different decision. But we're not sitting here getting done at the meeting and then having a conversation 2 hours later and saying, oh, never mind, we're not doing that. And that decision, that kind of combination of getting a lot of feedback, but then making a decision and that being it. Is very rare, but is incredibly powerful in an organization that needs to grow really, really fast.
I couldn't agree more. I get the sense sometimes people appreciate there's no such thing as perfect information. So, what better way to learn than make a decision and then incorporate the consequences down the line if you need to pivot? I couldn't agree more.
Totally,
Do
totally.
you see patterns around single founders, co-founders?
No, not really. No, we got co-founders to start businesses. I mean, I think, it's important to figure out who's in charge, I'd say is maybe the thing. And I mean, like you need to have like a CEO. I mean, as soon as there's companies that have kind of co-CEO examples that are really successful out there. But 95% of them have one person. So even though you might have a co-founder dynamic where they both are equal founders and they both have equal voting rights, usually there'll be one person who's been assigned to make the decisions. And so by that kind of classic like CTO CEO kind of combination, there's a head of product, there's a head of the business, like that dynamic is important. But yeah, I don't we have plenty of companies that have multiple founders. We got companies with single founders. I don't think it's can't tell you.
Fair. Okay, so coming back, I was able to infer what I presume is a lot of the criteria you use during your due diligence to make decisions. If we can unpack tech, obviously a lot of segments within financial services and fintech. Love to know what you're currently bullish on. And of course, you know what my next question is going to be is what's the role of artificial intelligence?
We are bullish on technology. I'll say, like, I mean, I think I'll answer your question. Maybe I'll flip it a little bit on its head. I can look at our, I've been investing since 2015, and I break up my investing career into really kind of three periods. One is like from when I started until COVID, which is just kind of like in hindsight, in the time it didn't feel this way. In hindsight, it's just kind of a generic up and to the right kind of thing. Just doing pretty well. And then COVID was this extreme whipsaw where the world was ending. And then within a few months, it was like there's never been a better time in fintech. And then it collapsed again. And that runs for me, let's say, I don't know, March 2020 until sometime in middle of, like the Terra Luna collapse in mid-2022, which was like this huge fraud in crypto, and it basically spilled across to everything. It was like the first kind of canary in a coal mine that maybe fintech and crypto, which I think any normal person considers to be part of fintech, there's problems here. And then I would say starting with the launch of ChatGPT, like 3.0, was the next thing. Where, as kind of around that same time, so this is kind of end of 23, you had just a significant change in a lot of like the Copilot and a lot of the coding assistants that were there. And what it has allowed is, I mean, we look at every company in the portfolio that was started after January 1st, 2023, they make more money now and are growing faster, and we have less dilution in those positions than everything we did in COVID combined. And there were more companies that were invested in during the COVID period. I mean, that was a longer period of time, and those companies now have had more time to grow, because this is just such a transformative technology in the environment of creating something new. And like, I mean, for you, I mean, you're starting, you got a new business. We talked a little bit before we started this. Like, you've got a new business. I'm sure you're using some of these tools, and they allow you to extend yourself. And the benefits of it inure most to those people who are the best at their jobs. And so for those founders who were like these 10x engineers before, they're now like 100x engineers. I mean, seriously, we have teams that are a fraction of the size of what I would expect them to be 5 years ago that are shipping more product more quickly and growing revenue faster than anything before. I mean, it is a remarkable impact on startup creation. And so for us, what that means is we're investing in people who can take advantage of these trends. So it's a lot of technical founders. It's a lot of people who have incredible skill already in the category. And we're trying to meet them really early. And like, our model is one where we try to kind of open up, reduce roadblocks for them. And we found as the best founders who can harness that technology are able to take advantage of it the best.
So, tiny pivot then. What are your thoughts on the implications for venture capital if all of a sudden, revenue per employee increases multiple fold and founders start kicking the future financing can down the road?
It's a very good question. Obviously, I'm selfish for early stage investors. So from a self-interested standpoint, it's gonna help us if we're in the right companies. I think it will probably lead, venture capital has, is going through a bit of an identity crisis right now and kind of an evolution of the business model. We could also call that a maturation of the sector. I mean, some of the, I do think that some of the bigger firms are do have a different business model now than they might have had 20 years ago or 15 years ago when they got started. And I think that business model is likely to be successful. They're basically becoming, kind of the investment banks of the innovation economy, and they're able to create products that, allow a lot more capital to flow into private technology companies than was possible before. Do I think that you can 10x an $8 billion fund? No, probably not. And so, but I also think that most of the limited partners, the investors who are investing in those funds, know that too. And they're not expecting these things to 10x. They're expecting them to, marginally outperform, the QQQ, and have a little bit of illiquidity premium. Yeah, I think for us then that creates a lot of opportunity, but also means, it's a more fragmented fundraising environment. And so I think for other funds like ourselves, or peer funds and funds maybe a little bit later stage, it's become harder to raise capital. And I don't think that's good because, you're going to have a situation where there's, probably in the near term, less capital flowing to the founders at the very earliest stages and these middle stages. And not every business is, I mean, very, very few businesses start at like pre-seed and just go straight up with no problems. And so you do need capital between kind of, pre-seed and Series D, to flow from many sources to have a really rich and robust and healthy, funding market. My instinct is that, we're going to probably have a couple of vintages where we get some really high performing early stage funds and some really poor performing multi-stage funds. And, other entrepreneurs and step into the gap and figure out new strategies to create new VC platforms in kind of that middle section. I mean, there's very few barriers to entry in venture capital. And
Sure.
so I don't think these opportunities are going to last for a really long time.
Okay. Also, then I'd love to build on that then, let and get your perspective on implications for secondary market and IPOs.
I think we're going to get more IPOs. I think we have one public company in the portfolio, a company called Dave.com, that it went through a de-SPAC transaction late 2022. A stock just got, I'm sorry, early 2022. Stock just got totally hammered. I mean, literally during the lockup, it dropped down below where we, like, well below our purchase price, and we were really early. And then the company, basically rebuilt itself. I would argue as effectively as an AI company based on like the time they were doing it and like how much technology they just added to it because they couldn't hire people, they couldn't raise capital. They were like a public company with a really low stock price. And that stock, you know, last year was the best performing financial services stock. You know, came from $5 to like end of the year at like 80 or 100. And then so far it's up another 80%, 100% this year. I don't know the number. Like it's just been just on a rocket ship climbing back up. And I think that if that company hadn't gone public, I don't think it'd be as in strong a position as it is now. I think it brought a lot of discipline to it. So I think the public markets are a really good disciplinarian for founders, and I think you're going to get more of them coming. I think fintech's a source of, you know, pretty persistent source of IPOs. I mean, historically, you know, we get four or five IPOs a year in fintech. We actually had a couple few last year, and the only ones people are talking about this year are fintech companies. And so I think it's going to come back.
Great. So obviously a tremendous amount of professional knowledge within financial services. And I can absolutely see how there are limited partners who would want to invest in Restive. But any intangibles you can share with us is how you think about running the firm that has been a real beacon for the partners and how you work with your LPs.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's a lot, obviously. I mean, yeah, I think one of our, you know, core kind of principles is, you know, is respect the founders. And so, you know, we think that starting these companies is like a really high, like a noble pursuit, and it's extraordinarily difficult and incredibly challenging personally and professionally. And so we want every interaction we have with a founder to be one where they come away with some value. And, you know, obviously the vast majority of the time when we meet someone, we're going to end up passing on the investment. But we get a huge amount of deal flow and a tremendous amount of goodwill and doors that get opened because when we meet someone at that earliest stage, they get some value from us, so we can give them some advice, something actionable. Look, we'll never tell a founder that they're too early, because we're supposed to be the too early investor. So if we tell them they're too early, then like that's completely worthless advice to them. So how can they be like, how can they make themselves investable? How can they get more people to be excited about what they're doing? And I think that ethos has translated to the LP base in a way that's allowed us to be really transparent about what we're investing in, what our strategy is, why we're excited about something, why we're not excited about something. And like, you know, also it means that we're kind of by nature, since we're investing in people, we're always investing. And we learned really early on, actually, when COVID happened, like every other investor in the world, we kind of put our heads in the sand and looked at our financials and try to think about, I don't know, how long companies could survive with the cash they had. And that was a completely wrong approach. And we missed some great deals in early 2020. And so when this last phase happened, we were very clear with our LPs that we're not going to break pace. We're going to continue investing in finding great founders. And lo and behold, we found amazing companies. And so I think it's created kind of a culture of transparency and being really clear about what our strategy is and how we're gonna, you know, make money that I think our LPs have appreciated. And it, you know, it kind of has flown both ways. You can't really be, you know, treating the founders with a lot of respect and being transparent about what they're doing, and not communicate that information up the chain.
Sure.
And so I think that that's really helped us.
You know, without revealing any trade secrets, you know, I've had the perspective that a venture capital business is somewhat analog because there's a lot of conversations that need to take place as part of deal flow. But have you started incorporating AI into any of your workflows, or, you know, have you seen opportunity to start taking advantage of technology to digitize Restive?
Yeah, I mean, I use we have AI. I use all of us, I think, use these AI note takers. Eh, mixed bag. I think the trade-off is you stop remembering things if you're not taking notes. So like, you gotta be careful. And I think, you know, we can take those when we do a deal. You can drop your. I mean, it's really easy. Drop your notes. I mean, into you know, ChatGPT or Anthropic or Claude, and have it generate an investment memo. I mean, we're still gonna read the memo and edit it. but you saved yourself a bunch of time. We're so early that I think we probably could do things where we're investing in agents that are going out there and looking on LinkedIn for everybody who's working in stealth and had like a financial services career. I'm sure people are doing that. But we haven't probably done as much as we should. So far, it's been a lot more focused on productivity improvements and in marketing. I mean, you use it for generating kind of first drafts of blog posts and things like that. Obviously, that helps. But so much of what we're doing is like, honestly, it's like phone calls. And like right before this podcast, I had a founder text me. He's like, "Hey, I'm dealing with a big client. Got a quick question running by you." And I mean, I didn't give him any advice, any information. He didn't know. He just wants someone to talk to. And then that's, I think, a little, part of a lot of what the business is doing is you're a sounding board, you're a source of advice. Very rarely, hey, maybe you should think about this more. And there's just not a lot of productivity enhancements you can do there. I mean, sometimes we just need to vent for 2 hours on the phone, and like, what are you gonna do?
Totally makes sense. And I think it's a good distinction to call out between copilots and agents. I think at this point you're seeing more ubiquitous adoption of copilots. Everyone seems to have a ChatGPT account at this point. If you don't, you should probably have one. But we've only just started experimenting with automation, and it's really use case centric. Because it doesn't seem like there's any escaping, just QAing what we're doing. But we've had guests who've done a great job of pointing out. It's like, well, being in the Bay Area, look at Waymo. We've got cops now who can navigate and make decisions around, effectively quality. Should I go, not go, with this? So, if we can come back to the founder side, how are you guys thinking about agents? Do you think it's still way early innings and you're going to be really cautious, or are you liking what you're seeing and you're seeing some pretty amazing companies tackling some pretty worthwhile problems?
I think they're completely on the present at this point. I mean, we, yeah, I mean, as far as the companies like deploying them as part of like things we're investing in, yeah, I think you have, I would be surprised if any of our stronger teams didn't have multiple kind of custom-made agents running and all sorts of different parts of their workflow. You just think there's so many areas where you want to highlight it, like and a lot of this stuff is you're putting a new skin on what would have otherwise you just kind of been kind of just masks and kind of screen scraping and ingesting data and kind of sort of, I mean, it's not, I think these aren't necessarily new workflows, they're just more productive. And so what would have been just a huge amount of kind of brute force coding before can now just be done a lot more quickly. And so you think, like a customer service flow, like they had, kind of decision trees for 30 years now, where you press a button to go to so and so, and then it was kind of voice automated, and now that's gotten to be just a lot more sophisticated, a lot cheaper to deploy, and they're kind of doing some of this customer service kind of decisioning. I think Dave, the public company, has been very public about talking around how they're using AI and kind of their credit underwriting decisioning. So yeah, I mean, I think they're pretty common. We have consumer businesses we've invested in that are now purporting to be an agent for you. The company, a really early stage company, which is kind of relevant, I think, maybe to your audience, called Finny.ai. That basically superpowers financial advisors. So somebody who's trying to grow their book of clients, and what Finny does is just pulls in all this data, and so it can say something like, "Hey, I wanted outreach to everybody who's moved to, Bozeman this year and bought a house for more than $5 million." Right, and joined this golf club and this ski club. And so I can then start pulling that together and then send them, start sending them automated emails and figuring out like, hey, well, what do they like? How do we get my name in front of this really targeted person? And that, that's just supercharges who are already really productive agents. And that's what I think is really interesting. It's like you're seeing these benefits in there to kind of the highest performers already are the most aggressive adopters of these technologies.
I mean, it sounds like we share a similar vantage point. I think it's never been a more exciting time to be within the early stage ecosystem. Because kind of like you, I mean, the things that I'm seeing are just incredible. And the product, I don't think it's interesting. I don't, know that people normally like unpack GDP and what the variables are, but productivity is massive. And historically, it's just been more people. But oh my gosh, I mean, we're all doing things in a fifth, a sixth of the time it would normally take, if not more, and you can't help but wonder, as you pointed out, companies are generating a lot more revenue with less people than they have in the past.
And I mean, as in the early stage business, revenue is a trailing indicator. Revenue is like a deep trailing indicator of progress. And so, you think about a startup that might be booking $1 million in revenue today. They probably started the conversation with those customers a year ago. And so if they were, and many of these companies were using tools that are really, I mean, they were using these tools last year when they were booking those things. And so they now have gotten a lot better at it, and they're just, the efficiency's improving. And so that's when you look forward, you just see these, I mean, you start seeing behavior within these companies' financials and performance. It just is seemingly unbelievable. And if it weren't happening to so many companies and not and in many cases producing actual cash, you wouldn't believe it. You're like, there's no way that's happening. And so, yeah, I agree. It is remarkable, but I also don't think that people necessarily realize like how far advanced some of these companies, early stage companies, have gotten in just the last couple of years.
Oh, it's nuts. And we have a handful of clients whose growth trajectory is mapped what you just described. And for many of us, we've never seen something like this before. I mean, you'd probably have to go back to the dot-com boom to see something similar. Then I don't even know that the revenue was there necessarily, just the stock
Yeah,
price.
it's there then. But there are stories like eBay has the stories like their early performance, like when the company first launched. I mean, these like unreal stories, and then the company was like, it was put public within like 18 months of starting, and like just completely would take over entire markets and create new markets of people who were trading goods, and they basically kind of the entire idea of a marketplace got created there in like a couple of years. So yeah, I think that actually is true. It's just what's interesting here is it's the productivity gains are just being impacted across the entire ecosystem. It's not just like one great idea. It's people with like relatively generic ideas who are just out executing now. And that's part that's like kind of remarkable.
Yeah, the golden years. There's a lot of analog that needs to be digitized. Ryan, it's a great podcast. Before we wrap up, two questions that I'd love to finish with. One, kind of a retrospective I enjoy asking all of our guests is if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, any age, your choice, what would you share with yourself?
Just don't worry about it. Just keep going. Just do what you're doing. You hear, we were just hiring somebody relatively recently, and they had an offer more money than we have, we were going to pay them. And it's just like, listen, this is just not, it's not important. Like, what you want to do is like, you want to do things you want to do. And like, money is like the worst, actually the worst way to make a decision is for money. Like, it is, money's an outcome of other things, or it's compensating for things, but it shouldn't be like your thing you're trying to get. Even in venture capital, like, honestly, if you're trying to optimize the cash you get out of this business, it's like, it's a terrible strategy. And so I didn't really make a lot of decisions that were really financially driven. And I don't know, a problem. I mean, but we're doing pretty well here. But more importantly, I think we're doing a really good job of like doing what we're doing. And that gives you just a lot more appreciation. It allows you just to do a lot of them like harder things to the job. Like the job is not like there's most jobs have a lot of really annoying, frustrating things that, where you feel like I'm not doing a good job at this part of the job. Like there's a lot of parts of this of running Restiv that I feel like I do a bad job at, where I could definitely improve. And you need to go and do things you just don't want to do for like hours and hours and hours on end. And it's much easier to do that if you feel like you're kind of motivated by the overall package of what you're doing and like the goal you're driving towards. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, just kind of finding things that you like and just trying to stay in that lane, being interested and just continuing to kind of pursue that, I think is just really important, even if it feels at times that it's not super valued by the economy.
I agree wholeheartedly. I didn't come up with it, but money's just a way to keep score. And so you got to think about how you get the digits on the scoreboard. It's focused on the outcome. And I'm sure like yourself, I had know a ton of people who left for Wall Street after undergrad, submitted themselves to some painful hours. And I'm no stranger to hard work, but they have dollar signs in their eyes. And yes, you'll accumulate great experience, but there's a lot of other fun and exciting things out there that we can focus on where the money will follow. So 100% agree. Last question. If there was anyone else you would like to see on this podcast, anybody, who would that be?
So I'm gonna, the favorite, because I have the person I'm gonna nominate actually mentioned me on another podcast once where someone else came up and he was on this podcast and the guy said, "Well, who's our good investor I should talk to?" And he said, "Oh, Ryan Falvey at Restiv." And he talked to me. And the podcast went on, and I got the only time this has ever happened in the history of running the venture capital fund, I got someone who pinged me on LinkedIn who had heard the podcast and said, "Hey, I heard you run a good venture capital fund. I want to invest," and invested in the fund. So like never happens before. Totally. This guy, Parker Burrill, and he actually lives up kind of near you. He works for Norwest. He's kind of later stage, does kind of everything, C through kind of Series B. And he is a great investor. I had actually he did the Series B on Dave, so that's how I got to know him, and took a bet on it. And that, I mean, he paid pretty high price when he invested, and the company again was just not good at all when it went public. It was really in the dumps, and he stuck with it the entire time. And now it's back, and I think it's and you know. To do that, it's one thing to do that when you run a small emerging fund and it's just a relatively small dollar position or early. And it's a totally different thing to do that when you're talking about tens of millions of dollars in a multi-billion dollar fund. And that guy has so much conviction in his investments when he makes them. And is also somebody that's incredibly helpful to his founders. I mean, we've had him come speak to our founders, and he's just like a human Rolodex of advice and connections. And like, I'm trying to hire somebody. He's like, "Okay, well, let's get down to the details of the job. Let's like, how do we think about like exactly what the function here? Okay, now I'm gonna go out there and find that person for you." And so I think he's a phenomenal investor. He's a really nice guy. And he's just got a tremendous amount of loyalty in to his ideas and conviction behind them that I think make him a really one of the best investors at kind of period. End of story.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing. And you took the words out of my mouth. I was like, all right, we're going to have an episode devoted to conviction, and we're going to see if we can't get Parker to take the spot.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
Ryan, really appreciate your time. Great episode. If there are any of our members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I use obviously LinkedIn and Twitter. If you're starting a company, just email me directly, ryan@restiv.com. We take all interests. We're always happy to chat.
Fantastic. Ryan, thank you. And again, for the benefit of our members, Ryan Falvey, founder and investor of Restiv Ventures. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. This has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.